go ahead and start since we've got. Here comes Charlie. Call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is the Wednesday, the 26th of January, 2005. It's now 8:38 a.m. in the morning. We have with us in Juneau, Senator French, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins. Online, we have Senator Guess. We're going to start out this morning with part of the review of the Department of Law, and we have with us this morning Mr. David Marcus. David, welcome.
Thank you.
We have.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is David Marcus. I'm a Chief Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska's Department of Law and its legislative liaison. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you with an overview of the key functions of the Department of Law. Unfortunately, both Attorney General Greg Rankus and Deputy Attorney General Scott Nordstrand are unavailable this morning, but we are pleased to start our overview today and complete it at a later time. Alaska Statutes 4423020 sets forth the duties and powers of the Attorney General. Simply stated, our mission is to provide legal services to state government and to prosecute crime. The Department of Law prosecutes all cases involving violation of state law and represents the state in all civil actions in which the state is a party. The Department administers state legal services, including the furnishing of written legal opinions to the governor, the legislature, and all state officers and departments, and gives legal advice on a law, or proposed legislative measure upon request by the legislature. Our department is divided into three main sections: the civil, criminal, and administrative divisions. As I said, unfortunately, Deputy Attorney General Scott Nordstrand isn't here this morning, but Susan Parks, the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, and Catherine Doughty, our Administrative Services Division Director, are present. Susan Parks will give a brief presentation, and Catherine Doughty is available to answer any questions about our proposed or current budget. In our handouts today, we have provided a top-level organization chart and 15 or so pages regarding our budget, which you can read at your leisure and get a more detailed picture of our department, including our accomplishments for 2004. You can also find more detailed information about our department on our website, including our latest annual report issued in May of 2004. We will present another report this coming May. We attempted to provide you with a copy of our 2004 report, but I think there was a mix-up in the copying. If you don't have it, we'll get it over to you today. With that, I would like to introduce Susan Parks. I look forward to working with you this session.
Thank you, Mr. Marcus. Good morning, Ms. Parks. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here. For the record, I am Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, and I'm happy to provide a little overview of how the Criminal Division is organized and our main functions. We do have a very unique Department of Law system in the state of Alaska in that our Attorney General is appointed and all of our district attorneys are also appointed, unlike many states in the lower 48 where you have elected prosecutors from county to county. We have a unified system, which I believe gives us some unique opportunities to have consistency within our criminal justice system, and also gives me, as the head of the Criminal Division, a unique ability to shift resources as needs arise, since everybody works for me, everybody works for the governor, and we can put the resources where we need them in the state, depending on caseload needs or what's happening in a particular community. The Criminal Division's main function is all adult criminal prosecution throughout the state. The state does all felony prosecution There are a few areas where there are local municipal prosecutors that handle a few misdemeanor cases. Municipality of Anchorage actually has quite large Department of Law that prosecutes misdemeanors. The Fairbanks City and Juneau actually do a few, but even the bulk of misdemeanors throughout the state are handled by state prosecutors. We also, last year, one of the changes that was made in the Department of Law was that the Criminal Division became solely responsible for all juvenile delinquency prosecutions as well. It had been sort of a joint civil criminal responsibility up until last year, when the decision was made to move it solely into the Criminal Division to take advantage of the trial experience of the lawyers in the Criminal Division, and again to keep some consistency. And so we're still in transition with that, but I think it's working well. We have 13 offices statewide. They range from, we've got four solo attorney offices, one in Barrow, one in Sitka, one in Dillingham, and one in Kotzebue. And then we have, of course, our largest office in Anchorage of approximately 30 lawyers, and then offices spread throughout the state. The department overall, we have approximately 95 prosecutors and about 25 victim witness paralegals. And I'd like to mention our victim witness paralegals, because they play a key role in our mission. They do provide trial support to our attorneys, but they also are the people who carry the main responsibility of fulfilling the Department of Law's fulfillment of victims' rights. They're the people that keep in contact with our victims, our witnesses, keep them informed of, you know, when court hearings are happening, what the procedure is, when they need to be in court, and getting their input on disposition of cases. So they are very important to us and our mission. Last year, and I'd like to thank the legislature, we were given an increase of 9 prosecutor positions. 3 of those were federally funded, 6 of them were with general funds, and we're very appreciative of that. That has helped us do a better job in handling and processing cases. Our caseloads do continue to increase. We've had enormous increase in felony cases, and as the legislature, I'm sure, is aware, you know, Alaska leads the nation in sexual assault, sexual abuse, and we have a very high incidence of violent crime. So even when you look at the numbers of cases we process, those kinds of cases take more resources, take more toll on the system, and so the additional resources have been very helpful. Just to give you an idea of the kinds of numbers we're talking about, for example, in 2002, we had 6,100 new felony referrals throughout the state. Last year, that increased to 6,900. So we had, you know, 800 additional new felony referrals throughout the state just in a 2-year period. Our misdemeanor referrals also went up from 2002. We had approximately 22,000. They went up to 22,700. So, you know, there's where our new prosecutors are going to handle all these increased cases. The challenges that I see for us continue to be handling the caseloads, particularly in light of recent court events. The Blakely decision has been a challenge for us this last year, and I'm appreciative of the swift action that the legislature's taking on that. Another challenge that we face, I think a lot of departments face, is recruitment issues. We've gotten these new positions. We've hired, since the beginning of the fiscal year, July 1, when we got the new positions, we got 9 new positions. We've hired 16 new prosecutors throughout the state, but we're still down because there is continuing turnover. I'm grateful for the openings we've had due to some appointments to the bench. I think we've gotten some excellent people named to the bench from the department, but it does create openings that need to be filled. We're losing experienced prosecutors. It's particularly difficult in our real rural areas, remote areas of the state, where it's very hard to find good qualified attorneys who are want to go out there, take their families out there, and become part of the community and prosecute. This year in our budget, you will see that we are, because we got the new positions last year, what we've asked for this year are two new paralegal positions. We're trying to add some support for those new attorney positions we got by adding some paralegal support so that we can continue to fulfill our statutory duties for victims' rights and provide the trial support. That's really all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about the criminal division.
Questions? Senator Guest?
No, thank you.
Anyone else? You just mentioned, Ms. Parks, part of the problem in being able to staff in the rural areas. You're saying, is that primarily, give us a little idea of the difficulty that you're having there. Explain that just a little bit more, if you would.
Sure. Especially, for example, our solo offices, it can be a very tough lifestyle for especially a prosecutor. I've talked to prosecutors who go to very small communities. You're the only prosecutor in town. You may be single. It's a very isolating position to be in. You are kind of a focus of the town and often not very popular. I think it's sometimes the same as being the only police officer in a town. And there are some people who don't like working without a support system. We also have issues of housing. Housing is very difficult to find in a lot of our smaller areas, smaller towns, even a town like Bethel where we have six attorneys. Housing can be an issue. Folks who have a spouse or significant other who has a career, it can be difficult for them to find job opportunities in these communities. People who have children involved in school and school activities, that may be much more limited. So there's all these factors, I think, that impact people's willingness to go to a very small, very isolated community, and it limits our ability to get especially experienced prosecutors. Often people straight out of law school who just want a job and an opportunity may be willing to go. We need experienced people, though, especially in our solo offices, and that's hard to get.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Parks, I'm fixing to give you an attagirl. My wife routinely in the evening talk about, and she has this thirst for what's going on, who you talking to, and what do you think? And I have this short list of people that I've told her about, and you're at the top of that. And I guess, said another way, the people that work for you should be proud of you because you represent them very well, and I'm proud to have you representing them before us. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. I appreciate that.
Senator French.
I'll keep cheerleading going. I used to work for Ms. Parks, and it was a fantastic experience. I guess I want to ask, though, while we're talking about rural recruitment, is, you know, I was long a believer that salaries are not competitive in the Department of Law vis-a-vis the civil world or the private world. A four-year DA can leave that job making between $50,000 and $60,000 and go across the street to a private firm and immediately get a $30,000 bump in their salary. That's a big differential. That's asking a lot for people to give up that much. You know, if it's less, a lot of people just want to be in court, love the action, you know, willing to do the job. But at a certain level, it's just going to be real tough to continue to attract good people if the salary disparities are not addressed. Is there anything in this year's budget proposal that does that?
Senator French, through the chair, no, there's not anything in there, and that is an issue, obviously. Particularly, law school is continuing to get more and more expensive. Undergraduate school is more and more expensive, so we're seeing, like a lot of professional careers, people coming out of school with lots of debt, and it does make it much more difficult for someone who wants to do public service to take a public service job where maybe you're not going to make as much money. So that is an issue for some people.
I'm not made any secret. I have a son who's a prosecutor in the Fairbanks market, and that's one of the things he'd like is a raise. He keeps telling me that.
Well, I would be happy to give all my employees a raise. I've worked for the Department of Law since 1987, and mainly in the criminal division, and it's hardworking, dedicated people in both the criminal and the civil division who work very long hours. And really, much of it is out of a sense of public service and not because you're going to get rich because you're not.
Yeah. Well, I agree that they work long hours. It's interesting to note my son did work in private practice first, and I think he works longer hours working for the Department of Law than he did when he was in private practice with a tremendous workload. I will tell you that to me, because I have that focus there, I see how not just my son but the other members of that office put in a tremendous amount of time trying to do the best job that they can under the circumstances. And that to me is an issue, because when I look at, as you mentioned, what it costs to go through undergraduate school, 4 years there, three more years of law school, then you put someone in a position where they say, we won't pay you as much as you could maybe make in private practice, and we're going to move you to an area that's going to be totally foreign to you, and you're going to go through some kind of culture shock. You will be a center of focus. I don't know how in the world you get some people to do that. I mean, and that's one of the questions that I have as I look at not only the Department of Law, but the court system that we try to make available for people across the state of Alaska, is that we have, in so many areas, limited resources, but yet we try to keep a local venue. And I wonder if you have any comment about the total challenge of that you've experienced in the Department of Law, in your criminal division.
Well, Senator Seekins, it is a challenge, I think, for the whole system. I mean, I've shared my experiences with the corrections, for example, who they have trouble getting, probation officers, same kind of recruitment issues. I think Health and Social Services has the same issues with juvenile probation officers, social workers, court system. It makes it difficult, because what you end up having is a system always working kind of understaffed, which just exacerbates the problems. And in a lot of those communities, we have some of our worst social problems, the alcohol problem out in the bush, the higher rate of sexual assault, sexual abuse cases out in some of those communities. I mean, in our Bethel office, the percentage of their felony caseloads that are sexual related offenses versus Anchorage, it's much higher. And so sort of our areas of greatest need, we have the most trouble getting the most qualified people for. And so I think it exacerbates an already troubling situation.
Well, I'm glad to know that you guys recognize that need and are working to try to fill it, and I do appreciate that very much. Other questions?
Just a comment. I think, Senator Seekers, you and I are on the Department of Law Budget Subcommittee. Maybe we can work on this project there.
Well, I have no problem. I'm going to get pressure from here and from home, I think. Thank you very much, Ms. Parks, for being with us today. So we've completed the criminal law side review of the Department of Law. Unless, Mr. Marcus, you have anyone else that wants to present for us this morning?
Not this morning.
Okay. And so we'll continue on with Department of Law at a later date, and we'll carry that forward, as we know that it's sometimes difficult to coordinate schedules. So thank you very much for being with us. We do appreciate it. Let's move on to Senate Bill 65. Good morning. Who's going to present? Ms. Carpinetti?
We have lots of other people for you.
Okay. That chair looks like it sits really, really low.
It does, and you look really high.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we intimidating you?
No.
Okay, good. Ms. Carpenter, welcome to the Judiciary Committee. If you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Chairman, my name is Annie Carpinetti. I'm a lawyer for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I'm here to present, introduce Senate Bill 65 to you. The problem that the bill is addressing is violence in our schools. The governor is extremely concerned about the situation, although we are making progress in that regard. There are findings in the Section 2 of the bill that include the finding in Anchorage, at least, that 13% of Anchorage students who responded to a survey in 2003 were afraid in school, and that is that disheartening number is what this bill was originally intended to address, and it does so by adopting an aggravating factor in sentencing for school-related assaults and other person crimes. As we were researching and talking to people about the situation, we heard from prosecutors and police officers that there was another concern in the state relating to juveniles, and that is gun-related crimes by juveniles. So the bill includes another section which addresses that problem. The first is an aggravating factor which applies at sentencing in felony sentences to crimes against a person. That's a crime in violation of Alaska Statutes 1141. These crimes include homicide, assault, kidnapping, sexual offenses, robbery, and related matters. The proposed aggravating factor would allow a judge to increase the sentence for a person who's convicted of an offense prohibited under Alaska Statutes 1141 if the person directed the crime against a school employee while on school grounds or at school-sponsored events. Although aggravating factors apply specifically to felony offenses, it is a statement of legislative concern about particular behavior that we are free to, and we often do argue at misdemeanor sentencings. It would send a message to both juveniles and adults that the legislature takes violence in schools very seriously. In the second regard, for gun-related crimes, minors generally are prosecuted under the juvenile justice system, and the Division of Juvenile Justice is here to talk about their role in that regard. But for certain very serious crimes, 16 and 17-year-old juveniles are automatically waived to adult court. These crimes include murder, manslaughter, assault in the first degree sexual assault in the first degree sexual abuse, and arson in the first degree. This bill in Section 4 would add misconduct involving weapons in the first and second degrees to those crimes for 16 and 17-year-old juveniles that are automatically waived to adult court. Misconduct involving weapons in the first degree is a Class A felony. It prohibits the following conduct: using a gun during a drug crime, and drive-by shootings under circumstances manifesting substantial and unjustifiable risk of harm to persons or property. Misconduct involving weapons in the second degree is a Class B felony. It prohibits the following conduct: possession of a gun during a drug crime, and second, after having been convicted of a felony, either as an adult or adjudicated for what would be a felony as a juvenile, possessing a concealable weapon on school grounds. Misconduct involving weapons in the second degree also prohibits shooting a gun at a building where there's likely to be a person in the building or in a dwelling. After speaking to police officers and prosecutors, they're very concerned about the amount of this conduct that is happening in our state, and they support this provision to automatically waive 16 and 17-year-olds who engage in this conduct to adult court. It's very dangerous behavior, both to the children involved and to the people driving by in the cars or the people in the houses being shot at, and to, of course, everybody involved in the drug crime. In support of this bill, I believe there will be testimony of Ms. Carol Como, who's superintendent of schools for the Anchorage School District, and Sergeant Gil Davis, who is a sergeant in the Anchorage Police Department. I think they're online. And if there are any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them now or later.
Additional questions for Ms. Carpinetti?
If I could, Mr. Chairman.
Senator French.
I'm eager to hear from Carol Colon, of course, the Anchorage Sergeant, but you have a more statewide perspective, of course. And so I guess my question is, you know, how many of these are happening statewide? How many juveniles, whether in the last decade or year, are going to school and committing the A felony or the B felony gun crime while on school grounds?
Well, we'll have testimony from Division of Juvenile Justice, who has those figures,
great,
because right now we don't have them because we don't prosecute
it's
them.
It's one to a different arm of the
yes,
department.
Yes, and they will have numbers for you, at least for the last year. And I think Sergeant Davis can have some helpful information to you, too.
Thank you.
Carpinetti, would you just, you talked about possession of a concealed weapon on school grounds. Would you clarify for me how you were that discussion that you just had?
Okay. It's a Class B felony, excuse me, which makes it misconduct involving weapons in the second degree for a person who has already been convicted of a felony or a juvenile who's been adjudicated for a crime that would be a felony to possess a concealable weapon on school grounds.
Okay.
And that would be one of the offenses that under this bill would be automatically waived to adult court for a 16 or 17-year-old person.
The caveat is they have had to have been convicted prior.
Already convicted of a felony, yes.
Other questions? Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in respect to age groups, I don't know, my gut feeling as I read media accounts that age is creeping lower and lower, that we're seeing these sorts of offenses. Do you have any concern as a professional that we're going to see the same creep to 14 and 15-year-olds one of these days, or what do you see?
Through the chair, the creep in terms of the behavior or the creep
both.
In terms of...
Both. Both.
Well, I believe that the behavior creep is already there, and I think the Sergeant Davis will be able to give you information about that. In terms of automatic waiver, I think the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Law has been pretty firm that under 16 is not appropriate for automatic waiver. It is available for discretionary waiver, but at that age, there's a lot of time for the division to work with kids. And
you can ask for the waiver, is that correct?
You can ask for a court waiver. Judges don't grant discretionary waiver very often, but you can ask. And in appropriate cases, we do and they do, but it doesn't happen very often.
Additional questions for Ms. Carpinetti? Hearing none, seeing none, thank you. Who would you prefer to follow you? Sergeant Davis or Ms. Como?
They're equally compelling, I believe. Perhaps Ms. Como is... Sergeant Davis is a problem because he sits at a desk with 12 other people in the same room. So if he's on, maybe we should hear him first,
okay,
so that he doesn't have to have it.
Just want to see if you had a preference here.
That'd be great.
Okay, Sergeant Davis, are you with us this morning?
Yes.
This is Senator Seekins, chair of the Judiciary Committee, and you are now online with the Judiciary Committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record, we'd be eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Okay, my name is Sergeant Gil Davis. I am the sergeant in charge of the robbery and assault unit for the Anchorage Police Department.
Did we lose you there,
Mr.? No, I'm sorry.
Oh, sure. Go ahead if you have testimony you'd like to present to the committee this
okay,
morning.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was notified about this yesterday, and I unfortunately haven't got a very detailed testimony for you, but looking at the law, we would support this for a couple of reasons. One of them that we come across the most is we're getting hellacious numbers of shootings in the city of Anchorage, averaging 15 to 20 reports of bullet holes in cars, houses, businesses, and whatnot. As late as last Friday night at the Diamond Mall in South Anchorage at 5 p.m., we had a 17-year-old with three other individuals in a fight fire a gun through the door into the Diamond Mall. his compadre, who just turned 18, had a pistol with the serial numbers ground off. I get numerous reports from our patrol officers. We're finding cars, juveniles, almost all, every car's got a gun in it, usually stolen, serial numbers altered, etc. What this would do for us, and I agree that with the earlier statement I heard that numbers are an issue. I don't see that many that we actually prosecute as Class A and B felonies, and there's a lot of reasons for that. I saw on my data, in Anchorage only 11, there may have been more. They don't get prosecuted, again, for a lot of different reasons, but when we do get the prosecutions in the adult system, the first thing is that we get an adult felony on them. And that puts them into the adult probation system. It's the adult probation system, in our opinion, working with the probation officers on the street is much more effective in controlling these people than what the juvenile system can do. The juvenile system has a lot more restrictions. I think further prosecutions, having an adult felony on your, especially weapons related, on your book as opposed to juvie, makes the further prosecutions or enhances those prosecutions. It makes them a lot easier than trying to bring juvie records into the adult court. That's been my experience, though I'm not a prosecutor. And the last thing is that we are working with the U.S. Attorney's Office on a program called Project Safe Neighborhoods. Actually, we take people who continue to get involved in weapons-related crimes and run them through the federal system. The federal system cannot entertain a juvenile prosecution. So this would give us an added tool to go after some of these kids. Another problem comes down is that a lot of times I don't think these juveniles are prosecuted in the A and B level simply because they stay in the juvenile system, and I don't think there's a lot of confidence that they're getting the attention that they need. And a second issue that I wanted to bring up here is we go to shootings constantly. We usually catch the people. We can't prosecute them because they've got a car of 2, 3, 4 kids. There's firearms in the car. No one's talking. No one can identify the suspect, and there's really nothing we can do at that point in time. And we find that there's a big hole in the weapons laws with these kids for tools for patrol officers to use on the street, and that is between the ages of, 16 and 20. They can't have a handgun. They just can't have it concealed. And we've got ourselves in the square corner here where they have the right not to talk. They've all had attorneys. They've all been trained not to talk to the police. They've all got the standard story of, yes, I've held that gun. It's a friend of mine. I don't remember his name, but he let me hold it once. That's why my fingerprints are going to be on the gun. But I didn't shoot it. And the only witness we have is they saw a hand or a gun come out the window. If there were some way that we could address the situation of having kids under the age of 18, your 16 to 17-year-olds or your 17-year-olds, not being able to drive around town at 2 o'clock in the morning with loaded pistols in their car, that also would be something that would stop a lot of this gunfire. Our last anecdote I want to bring up is we went to one house on Pequot Street in Anchorage. It's a very nice subdivision. It's been shot up twice. From talking with the kids there, we found out a major gang fight between two groups. There were 3 shootings, and one of them occurred at 2 o'clock in the morning in a car's parking lot at Diamond and Jewel Lake, and we were actually able to make charges on that one. The only reason that wasn't a total travesty is the MAC-13 that was going to be used malfunctioned and didn't fire. So we've got a hell of a problem out here, and we need to do something. Getting things moved from the juvenile system to the adult system, I think, would be a big advantage, and the fact that we're getting out of treating them like little children and basically saying you want to run the streets and play like a big boy, you're going to go to big boy jail and deal with DLC, not NYC.
Okay, questions for Sergeant Davis? Senator French?
Sergeant Davis, it's Hollis French here in Juneau, and I thought I heard you say 11 cases, but it wasn't clear to me if that's 11 per month, per year, or what the frequency of those cases was.
Well, I only found 11 for the year, but that was my personal search through our database. I didn't have time to really sit down and go through the whole database. That's what I could find very quickly on my computer, that there were only 11 convictions, or I'm sorry, 11 arrests that I could find, robberies and assaults where a weapon was used that classified as a Class A and B felony. Unfortunately, I agree with the earlier statement that the juvenile justice is going to have better statistics.
Well, I think one's too many, but I guess I just need to make sure that these are crimes that happened on school grounds.
I'm sorry?
These are crimes that happened on school grounds, or
these are crimes that just simply citywide involved 16 and 17-year-olds that rose to the level of an A or B felony that involved a weapon.
Thank you. Got it.
Okay, other questions? Hearing none, thank you very much, Sergeant Davis. And we'll move to Ms. Como. Are you there this morning, Ms. Como?
I am. Thank you very much. I want to offer our strong support for these proposed changes in this Senate bill. We have been working very, very closely with the police department and the whole juvenile justice working group with Master Hitchcock and a number of different agencies trying to increase student safety in our schools and certainly in our community. We've also been working with U.S. Attorney Tim Burgess on the Project Safe Neighborhoods that Sergeant Davis just referred to, and I think we have made a significant inroad in educating our students that reporting suspicion of firearms or any weapons into their school administration or to the school resource officers now that we have in all of our comprehensive high schools is ensuring that our students are safer. But we are also seeing the spillover effect from what Sergeant Davis was reporting. When these juveniles get together out in the community, a lot of that spills back into the schools. We, and I haven't had time either today to research the statistics from last year, but we have not had many actual firearms brought onto our campuses in the last few years because we've really aggressively gone after this and sent the message of what the consequences are. But we do get all the spillover effect from the fights in the neighborhoods and out in the community on the weekends, or that something starts at school and then leads to fighting and shootings as a result of something that occurred at school. The other thing in this bill that we're very supportive of, but I would like to ask for serious consideration for expansion of the language, is in Section 3, where it says in that number 31, it says, while on school grounds or at a school-sponsored event, and I spoke with Ms. Carpinetti about this this morning, we would like that expanded to include all school employees while performing in their jobs or something like that, because we have people assaulting school bus drivers, we have people coming into our administration building, threatening to assault people that are working, and we've had to install silent alarm systems in this building and in other work buildings because of this, and the police respond quickly. But when people assault school district employees while they're performing their job, we don't think that's acceptable, and we'd like that language broadened from just schools and school-sponsored events. So that's basically my testimony.
Questions for Ms. Carpinetti? For Ms. Como? Seeing none, hearing none, thank you very much, Ms. Como.
Thank you very much.
Do we have additional questions for Ms. Carpinetti?
Could I just make one thing clear that I may not have made before clear enough, and that is that as we were doing this bill and just trying to decide what would be the best approach to it, when we talked about the automatic waiver, it was clear that the bad activity that we're addressing is not only on schools but in the communities too. There are some offenses that occur in the schools, but the majority of them are in cars, off grounds, or schools.
And that was my next question to you. I guess the question that I'll be asked by some of my constituents will be, why would we say it's bad, worse if you do it on school grounds or to a school employee, but it's not so bad if we do it to someone else at a different location or venue?
In terms of the aggravating factor?
Yes.
Well, you know, that's a good question, and people have made it often. Right now we protect police officers by making mandatory sentences for people who assault police officers because this group of people has a particularly dangerous job. They're in charge of protecting people, and the rationale would also apply to
school employees whose job is to be on the school grounds and to be teaching and protecting children. That's really a policy call for you to decide whether or not that is a group that deserves higher protection than other groups of public servants. But considering the public concern for violence in schools and the danger that assaulting teachers particularly has on not only the teachers who have been assaulted, but the children who see that, we come down in on the side of saying this group of people does need to be protected. This is a good legislative statement to make for people who work in schools and who teach our children and who are there to protect them too.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this point, this aggravator, if I recall correctly, aggravators allow a judge to increase a sentence but don't mandate an increase in sentence. The judge can look at the aggravator, weigh the aggravator, even find the aggravator, and decide in the totality of the circumstances that it doesn't merit an increase in the sentence.
That's absolutely correct.
And there's nothing in the new sentencing law we just passed out of the Senate that changes that, is there? Because it's a question I'm struggling with when I look at the other bill that's not before us, but it's the mandatory sentence. It's the fixed sentence for assault of a school employee that takes away the judge's discretion. This maintains the judge's discretion, because I think there's some instances where, you know, the core conduct is assaulting a school teacher in a classroom in front of a bunch of kids for no reason. I mean, that's, everybody knows that's wrong. But when you're assaulting a school custodian, when a school custodian and his landlord have a dispute over the rent in the parking lot, and there's a scuffle and an assault ensues, I think a lot of folks think, well, that's not really what we meant when we wrote this. And so you can get into some fine lines where a judge can look at that, decide, you know, the core conduct is, you know, teachers, administrators, even the custodian maybe while he's sweeping the halls, you know, in the middle of his workday. But there are other instances where it's sort of on the periphery of the conduct, and it's not maybe worthy of increasing a sentence beyond the presumptive.
That's correct.
So I'm more inclined to be in favor of the aggravator, and we'll talk about the other bill when it's before us. Thank you.
And I think as I look at the aggravator, as I understand, the aggravator will have to be now decided by a jury. Am I correct? If we pass the law that we have passed out of this committee?
Not for misdemeanors. Because
for misdemeanors.
But for felonies?
For felonies.
Yes, I believe so.
Now, I guess that's the one question that as I get into the aggravators that I hear the most often from people in general. I say, well, how about me? I'm a mall employee. I got kids around all the time. And it's a center of violence. We just heard there were shots fired in the Diamond Mall. Shouldn't I deserve some extra protection as well? And that's a legitimate concern as we continue to find special groups that deserve special protection. Just how far do we go?
I agree that people have those concerns, and we thought about that a lot, but we came down on the side of endorsing an aggravating factor which gives discretion to the judge under the circumstances to apply because of the serious problem with violence in our schools and the need to address it so that kids can learn and be in a safe place to learn and teach.
And I think that's one question we should ask Ms. Como, maybe. Sergeant Davis gave us some general figures as to how much violence there was, they were experiencing in the overall Anchorage community. Maybe we should ask Ms. Como, is there data to support increased violence? What does the data show of violence in the schools, other than the survey that we saw here that said 11% high school students responding to the survey reported having been threatened or injured with a weapon on school grounds. Is there a number of assaults that have taken place? Is Ms. Como, maybe, do you have any data on that?
If you could get us the questions, I think we could get that to you between pulling up with our police reports that we've gotten and also our own data. We could probably get that to you. It would take a few days, but I think we could get that to you if we knew exactly which questions you'd like.
Okay, thank you. Senator Terrio. Senator Terrio has joined us, by the way, on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry to be late. I'm not sure if you've had questions on Section 1, Section 2. wondering for Ms. Carpinetti. Number one is, well, I've had a longstanding, my time in the House, I've routinely dropped off findings and titling certain sections of statutes. Is there any particular compelling reason why we should call this the School Violence Protection Act of 2005? I mean, there are lots of things in the statutes that are aimed at preventing violence in schools. This does not encapsulate all those statutes. So why do we put a title on any particular section of statutes at all?
Through the chair, this was bills as they're drafted are works in progress, and they change from the beginning to the end. And people have looked at it and thought, well, this does cover other violence among youth in addition to school violence. So I think the rationale for having the title is may not be as compelling at this point as it was when we started out drafting the bill.
Mr. Chairman, next, is there anything in the findings and intent that couldn't be or shouldn't be just covered in a letter of intent from the committee? Because we've got here a particular student survey that was done in Anchorage, and we're writing these percentages into the statutes. I have no idea whether that's the same percentage in Naknek or Fairbanks. I have a lot of suspicion that when kids take these surveys, sometimes the way they fill out the survey is impacted by what happened to them in school yesterday, and that might be a good reason to, for them to feel that particular way that day. But it also is impacted by the episode on the OC the night before, and so it just seems to me like that putting this type of percentage information in the statutes is suspect to begin with. And can't we just cover that with a letter of intent and not build all this extra stuff into the statutes? If we're not mindful of this, I mean, this is a six-section bill with the effective date. Two of the sections are, in my estimate, stuff that we really shouldn't put into the statutes.
It has been the policy of the chair to encourage bills that leave this committee not to include special titles or findings and intent, but to cover it with a letter of intent. So far, we're 100% on that this year.
Well, through the chair, Senator Terrio, I would note that the findings and intent section is in the uncodified law, so it doesn't go into the statute book anyway. So whether you want to put it in the uncodified law or leave it in a letter, I think it doesn't matter either.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Guess.
Thank you. If we could go back to Section 3, I had a few questions. One is, what's the definition of a school employee? We all think about the classroom teachers, but there's employees that come in and out of the school, and I guess I'm still confused a little bit about who's covered and who's not, and if someone's on school grounds and is assaulted, we're treating it differently than if they're at a school board meeting at the administration building and they're assaulted. Can you talk about, is there a definition in statute already of what a school employee is and is not?
I don't believe there is a definition of school employee, although Ms. Como may be able to correct me on that. School grounds and school-sponsored events are terms that are used in other sections of our statutes and are not defined, to my knowledge, but have not been a problem in terms of courts understanding what they mean. I think the intent is to be fairly broad in this aggravating factor, and as Ms. Como said, to cover bus drivers and custodians and other employees of schools who are working at their duties, and including, she would like to broaden it to include administrators in administrative buildings. We could certainly make definitions of these if that would be something that you would desire, but as far as I know, these terms have been used and have not caused confusion.
The terms of school grounds and school-sponsored events have been used, but has the term school employee, because I don't know if it's common that a bus driver would be considered a school employee versus a district employee, given that they take kids and, they go to various schools and are at various places, and whether or not
a school bus driver on their school bus if it's not on school grounds and is assaulted, is that different than if they're assaulted on the school grounds, or is the bus considered school grounds?
I would consider the bus school grounds myself, but I think it is, as long as there's a question, we ought to make that perfectly clear.
And here you bring up a good point. In Fairbanks, the bus driver is not a school employee, not a district employee. He's an employee of a contractor.
Yep.
And
excuse me, this is Carol Como. That is not necessarily true. In Anchorage, we have district school bus drivers who are employees of the Anchorage School District, and we also have contractors.
Is it your intent only to cover your employees, Ms.
No, our goal is to cover any school district employee or a bus driver that's a contract who is engaged in performing their duty.
Well,
if somebody assaults them, we believe they should be covered.
And how about volunteers?
If that's a gray area for us, that's a very difficult area. But if they're volunteering in a classroom, for instance, like happened at Taku a few years ago, and a parent came in and hit the teacher over the head with a telephone, if that volunteer had been there working with a group of kids and the same thing had happened to them, we would have pushed hard for that to happen for them because they were really engaged in work at the school. But we have not discussed that part. We're really focusing right now on our school employees who are performing their job functions. We are not trying to get into their personal issues or any of that. We're truly trying to talk about all of our school employees while they're engaged in performing their work.
Senator Terrio.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you touched on the volunteers. You've also got food delivery people, some of them in the Fairbanks area work for the school district. They're delivering from the centralized kitchen, but the volunteers, the parents. We've got a strong effort in our elementary schools where to have parents be involved. Sometimes they're in the copying room and they cut and they copy and they, you know, punch holes and that type of stuff. So they might not actually be in the classroom instructing or helping to instruct. So I think we just need to be clear before the bill leaves the committee just who's in and who's out.
Absolutely. And go ahead, Senator French. I'll reserve my comments at the moment.
I volunteer at West High. I work in the Eagles Cache. It's a canteen that the parents run to raise a little bit of money for the PTA, and you show up for an hour and sell muffins and cheese sticks to the kids at lunch. They sell, what's that caffeinated drink they all love?
Jolt
and the other ones, Raging Bull and all that stuff. It floors me we sell that, but we do. And, the PTA makes, it's terrible. it's one of the big sellers, and the PTA makes money, and so that's just, I guess, an issue. Maybe more substantively, I read this youth risk behavior survey, and I guess I need someone to clarify whether this applies to Anchorage schools or statewide schools.
I would like Mr. Ruaro, who was more familiar with the findings, to come up and answer that question.
And before I leave that question, I am prone to look more favorably on this bill if the definition of those people who are covered is expanded beyond the narrow scope of school employees. Because as a parent whose wife was involved in day-to-day activities in classrooms, who was a volunteer himself in both junior high school and high school events, if I would think I would be remiss to say, I will go punch him, not her, because she's a school employee and he's just a volunteer. So I'm more inclined to look favorably if we're going to say there's a higher risk on school grounds that we try to protect all the people who are part of the equation rather than just a select group.
Thank you. It's clear that we do need a definition with all these variables. Thank you.
Go ahead. If you'll put yourself on the record.
Sure. For the record, my name is Randy Ruaro. I'm the Assistant Attorney General with the Legislation and Regulations section. And I did a little bit of work on the findings. And I think I can answer Senator French's question. The 2003 Youth Risk Behavior Survey was a statewide survey. It did include 42 public high schools in 19 different districts, and the responses were then weighted to get statewide numbers or estimates. So Anchorage was part of that.
Questions?
And that would have to make a change in the uncodified title. It would, if we're going to talk about school violence prevention, it wouldn't just be for school employees' violence protection.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I think my suggestion deals with that problem.
I do, too. So, additional testimony from people that are in Juneau on the bill today. Please. Welcome to Judiciary Committee.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patty Ware. I'm the Division Director for the Division of Juvenile Justice within the Department of Health and Social Services. I think Ms. Carpinetti has already spoken to the impact of the bill, so I won't repeat her testimony. I think what I can add to the discussion, and we have been working closely with the Department of Law and the administration on this bill, is to cover some of the questions that folks had about the numbers and what does it look like in terms of the juvenile system, because as has already been stated, Section 4 is going to expand the offenses that would then fall under the adult system if you are 16 or older. Based on data for two fiscal years, and that's fiscal year 03 and 04, we had 40 referrals come into the Division of Juvenile Justice that covered both misconduct involving weapons in the first degree and in the second degree. Of those 40, and again that's in a two-year period statewide, 26 of them were committed by kids who would now fall under this waiver provision. They were 16 or older at the time of the commission of the offense. So under this proposed bill then, we would be waiving approximately 13 additional juveniles per year into the adult system. And again, as Ms. Carpinetti already spoke to, these are serious offenses. You know, we certainly want to reduce the violence both in our schools and not on school grounds. I think we've already heard testimony from one of the police officers in Anchorage as well as Superintendent Carol Como. In terms of the details on kind of where did those offenses occur, how many of those were on school grounds, we've got both school grounds concerns as well as non-school grounds concerns. For the misconduct involving weapons in the first degree, the majority of those were basically not on school grounds, discharging a firearm from a car, essentially. And then in terms of misconduct involving weapons in the second degree, most of those, we got 12 referrals in the two-year period for possession on a school ground. And again, those are kids that had already been adjudicated of a prior felony, which is what that statute section of the statute requires. And then the other most common, we had 8 referrals on discharging a firearm at a dwelling, also under the second degree misconduct involving weapons of the statute. So we support the bill. I don't know if you folks have other questions in terms of the numbers or other questions involving the juvenile system, but I'd be happy to answer those if you do.
Questions for Ms. Ware? Seeing none and hearing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. We're going to take a 5-minute recess. We'll be back in a moment. We're back on the record. Thank you for being here. At this point, I don't see that there's anyone else that has... someone else wants to testify. I didn't see on the list, but come on up. Put yourself on the record. We're eager to hear your testimony.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Bruce Johnson with the Association of Alaska School Boards, and I just wanted to lend our general support for this this bill. We have had a resolution since 2002 that was passed by our membership and then revised this past November at our annual conference dealing with assault of school employees. And part of the definition issue that you've been talking about this morning was part of our conversation And it really is more of that holistic look of people working with young people in some official capacity, whether that's a volunteer employee, employee of a contractor. So we would urge that broad definition. I'd also just like to speak on behalf of rural districts, because in our conversation that came up a lot. Anchorage is one set of circumstances, along with other urban areas, but there are many challenges in our rural schools related to assault, verbal, and threats of physical violence against school employees. So we urge your consideration, and obviously this may need a little bit of work, and we'll stick with you and try to help you fashion something that will work well for our state and our children. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chump, what is your organizational position on the case of you're the teacher, student X accosts you outside the school grounds and says, I told you at school today I was going to get you?
Through the chair, obviously that's a difficult issue. We know that those things do occur around our state. I don't know how frequently, but we do hear those types of concerns expressed. Some make the news, others do not. Our sense is that something that carries over from the school, you know, to someone in their home or on their way to and from their home, related to school business, those sorts of things, that if it started as a result of your role as an employee or volunteer, that certainly we would hope that would be covered.
Thank you. Other questions? One of the problems that I have, and it has, we've already started to touch part of it, but we wanted this to be a School Violence Protection Act by the uncodified mention of the title. But if we pass this, what we are, and we have a survey here of students, says 11% of the high school students responding reported having been threatened or injured, etc. There's no survey of how many school district employees have been threatened. But yet, if we pass this law, it's a greater offense with an aggravator to have assaulted a school district employee than a student. So not only we're saying students are afraid, we need to protect them, so let's protect employees but not students with a greater aggravator. And volunteers and in Fairbanks, all bus drivers are contractors. They're not employees. The whole world doesn't do it the same way Anchorage does. So, you know, I think we need to work on, if we're really trying to somehow or another address the issue of people carrying concealed weapons and what effect that has on public safety in school or threats that are made against people in the school, that we need to look at putting everyone that's in that venue on an equal level, whether they're volunteers, students, or contractors, employees, or school district employees. And so while I laud the intent here to keep violence down against school district employees, I would really prefer that we try to look at the broader spectrum. And would your association have any problem with that?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, no, I'm sure that we would be very interested in working with the committee and others to make that happen. We value our children first and foremost, obviously. That's our lives revolve around that in public schools. So certainly we want them protected as well.
Appreciate that. Other questions? We have any other testimony so far on the bill? Well,
no
questions or comments now?
Well, more of a question, and I'm back on the study. Maybe that Attorney General, who's familiar with the study, can tell me. And I'm looking specifically at this page 8 that talks about carrying a weapon, carried a weapon on school property, and so forth. I think I know what carried a weapon on school property means, but I guess I started thinking about what carried a weapon means in general, and of course there's some bad ways of carrying a weapon, you know,
during a cocaine deal or you know, just concealing your person for bad purposes. But there's some perfectly lawful instances of carrying a weapon, for example, hunting and or carrying it for protection when you go fishing. And so I'm just wondering if carried a weapon, you know, what the definitional sort of range was on that phrase.
Through the chair, Senator French, I honestly can't speak to that. I just reported the straight statistic. You're right. There are instances of carrying a weapon that's perfectly legal. So.
I guess I'll try to find out who did the study, and maybe they can tell me. And I guess the other question, and maybe not the one to ask, but I'll just pose it, and that is, it looks like we've got a pretty good reduction in carried a weapon if we're, and I'm going to assume we're aiming at bad carrying a weapon and not hunting and fishing carrying a weapon or lawful carrying a weapon. But it looks like we got a pretty good reduction between 1995 and 2003. Does anybody know what led to that reduction? And are we going to make sure we keep doing that in addition to this proposed legislation?
Through the chair, Senator French, I can't specifically tell you. My guess would be, just from reading some of the articles and literature, is some of the increased funding that's been put in and actually posting peace officers at the schools. And I think Ms. Como talked about some of the progress that they've made with some of their efforts in the schools. So my guess would be that would be what's contributed to the decrease.
Thank you.
I guess what I wouldn't want to see happen, Senator French, if an adult came onto a school grounds to pick up their kid and they had a pistol in the console of their vehicle, that we somehow or another would come after them because they're carrying it concealed in a perfectly lawful manner, but they drove onto the grounds to pick up their school kid. But those kinds of things, I agree, we have to be very careful we don't get into. And that is a good question. Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, at the risk of expanding the conversation a little bit, as I read this 11 percentile and under the threat of a weapon by the students, you know, in my estimation, and talking to students, my wife works in the school business, is that this thing called bullying is an 850-pound gorilla that is the biggest threat on the school grounds. Does your statistics bear that out anyway or refute it?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I don't have any bullying statistics to offer you. I could try and find, you know, some information. I know there was, I think, a convention or seminar in Anchorage this last year where a bunch of folks got together and talked about the problem, but I just off the top of my head, I don't have any statistics for you.
Okay, I don't want to get off on a tangent. Thank you.
Other questions? I think what we'll do, I would prefer that we take a look at the spectrum of people that we're trying to look at here and see if we can come up with a more acceptable group, so to speak. If the members of the committee agree that maybe that deserves some more work, I'll carry the bill over and we can do that and bring it back up under bills previously heard. Is there any objection to that?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Guess.
No, I would just ask that we also maybe think about what school grounds does and doesn't mean in the conversation about, especially about buses, that maybe the Department of Law can think about that as well.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. Thank you, Senator Huggins.
Well, I support your position, and clearly I think we agree that there's some ragged edges in this bill, and I haven't been involved in many of these, but it's clear to some of us that what we can't do is have legislation that has a focus on Anchorage because we're a statewide body, and we have to keep that mindful so that what we do meets the broader spectrum because it's about our state.
Right. Other comments before we carry this bill over? I'm going to carry this bill over and for some further work. And is there anything else to come before the committee this morning? Seeing none, this committee is adjourned.